you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden has been housing unaccompanied alien children from the southern border at temporary facilities at military bases. And reports from child advocates and people who have worked, the facilities are harrowing. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Nolan Rapport Ryder. This article is published under the heading Migrant Children at Military Bases. What is Biden doing? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. U.S. President Joe Biden has been housing unaccompanied alien children from the southern border at temporary facilities at military bases, and reports from child advocates and people who have worked at the facilities are harrowing. Why is the U.S. housing migrant children at military bases, and why is it treating them so poorly? What does it portend for treatment of migrant children under the Biden administration? A surge in the appearance of unaccompanied alien children at the southern border has overwhelmed Customs and Border Protection, CBP, and HHS Office of Refugee Resettlement, ORR, making it very difficult to provide proper care for the children. The number of unaccompanied alien children apprehended at the border nearly doubled from 4,852 in December 2020, the last full month of the Trump administration, to 9,266 in February 2021, the first full month in Biden administration. It rose again to 18,723 in March, was 16,908 in April, 13,892 in May, and 15,000. 18 in June. Two statutes and a legal settlement agreement require CBP to transfer unaccompanied alien children to ORR within 72 hours of their apprehension. This does not apply to children from contagious countries. ORR is responsible for the children's care until they can be placed with sponsors, usually family members who will maintain custody over them while they wait for an immigration hearing. ORR has licensed detention centers for unaccompanied alien children with a total of more than 13,500 beds, but the adjusted space requirements during the COVID-19 pandemic limited the number of children it can place at its licensed detention facilities. And the demand for bed space has gone up. As of July 15th, there were approximately 14,920 unaccompanied alien children in ORR custody. At the end of May, the system-wide average length of time these children were spending in ORR's shelters was 35 days. Consequently, ORR had to set up emergency housing facilities. This has included military bases in Texas, Joint Base San Antonio in Lackland, and Fort Bliss in El Paso. Previous presidents also have had to resort to using military bases for detaining unaccompanied alien children. In fact, the Obama-Biden administration did it. According to the Congressional Research Service, nearly 16,000 unaccompanied alien children were housed at military bases between 2012 and 2017. Because existing shelters were overwhelmed by the number of children being apprehended at the border. This time, however, Biden is one who is responsible for ensuring that the children will receive proper care, and he doesn't seem to be able to meet that responsibility. Biden set up a tent city at Fort Bliss in March. It has held as many as 4,500 boys and girls ages 13 to 17 in large tents, but it only had 790 children in July, all boys. It is capable of holding up to 10,000 children, which makes it the largest detention facility the U.S. regime has ever set up for housing migrant children. Unlike regular ORR detention facilities, Fort Bliss and other emergency centers do not have to have state licenses to certify that they can care for children. Representative Veronica Escobar, child advocates and contract workers have claimed that the Fort Bliss facility is poorly managed and that children in it are suffering. They say children wait for weeks without speaking to a caseworker who could connect them with a sponsor, that COVID-19, other infectious diseases, and lice are rampant, and that some contract caregivers lack adequate training to work with young children. The level of stress among the children has been so high that the government has had to monitor them for incidents of self-harm, panic attacks, and escape attempts. Pencils, pens, scissors, nail clippers, and regular toothbrushes have been kept out of the tents to prevent the children from using them to hurt themselves. In a letter dated on July 15, 2021, Earth Justice, the Hispanic Federation, Alianza Nacional do Campus, Green Latinos and Labor Council for Latin American Advancement called for the immediate closure of the Fort Bliss Detention Center. Among other things, they claim that Fort Bliss is unsafe because the army has failed to take the necessary steps to ensure that it will be free to toxic waste hazards. At least 80 contaminated sites have been identified at Fort Bliss. With more, two contractors who worked at Fort Bliss from May 12, 2021 to June 2, 2021 filed a whistleblower complaint in July. They say that the tents are massive. Each one has between 1,000 and 1,500 beds. Moreover, they are dirty and often smell like a locker room, and the presence of numerous portable toilets produces a sewage odor. Although many children are housed in these tents for as long as 2 months, it appears, according to the whistleblower's complaint, that their bedding is never washed. The children apparently also do not have enough clean clothes and other things, which makes them reluctant to exercise or to bath because they lack clean clothes to change into afterwards. Biden also set up a much smaller detention facility in a vacant dormitory at Joint Base San Antonio, Lackland, Texas. It had a capacity of only 372 beds for boys aged 13 to 17. Approximately 100 boys were put there on April 17, 2021. It was closed on June 30. The way migrant children have been treated at Fort Bliss makes one wonder how they are being treated at the rest of the detention facilities, especially the emergency centers that do not have to have state licenses. But what is worrying is that what happens to them when they leave the ORR detention facilities to stay with sponsors. How can Biden ensure that the sponsors will treat them properly when he can't ensure proper treatment while they're still in government custody?
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesley. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. American media is reporting that Israel's spying agency, Mossad, assassinated Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh last year. As Iran's intelligence had reported shortly following the terror act last year, Tel Aviv was responsible for murdering Dr. Fakhrizadeh. Now, the report also talks about the U.S.'s collusion in the terrorist act at the highest levels. Why is the U.S. media simply reporting this now, and why isn't terrorism condemned and the culprits made to pay instead of simply reporting that this rogue entity committed these acts as if that is normal? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this in the Spotlight.
He has revealed new details about the last year assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Israel was already long believed to have been behind the murder that took place on November 27, 2020. Immediately after the killing, an informed source told Press TV that the remains of the weapon used in the assassination showed that it had been made in Israel. But a recent New York Times article publicizes fresh information, including the fact that Fakhrizadeh was at the top of Israel's hit list since 2007. That entailed an assassination plot in 2009, which was called off at the last moment, as Israel's spy agency Mossad feared its scheme had been compromised. The article by the American Daily also confirmed earlier declarations by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC had said a satellite-controlled machine gun with artificial intelligence was used to take out the scientist. Perhaps most significantly, though, the report sheds light on the extensive collusion of the U.S. in the assassination. It says preparation for the operation began after a series of meetings in late 2019 and early 2020 between Israeli officials and high-ranking American authorities. Those meetings were led by the then Mossad director, Yossi Cohen, and former U.S. President Donald Trump, his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and the then CIA director, Gina Haspel. Fakhrizadeh's killing was the latest desperate effort in the joint Israeli-U.S. venture to derail Iran's nuclear program, a campaign that has included several other assassinations, acts of sabotage, and cyber attacks. While promising revenge and justice, Iran has refused to be cowed and remains resolute in pushing ahead with its nuclear program. However, the brazen U.S. and Israeli violation of international law and human rights should alarm the international community, whose apathy and muted response may come back to haunt it.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight, Hafsakar Mostafa, journalist and political analyst out of London. And Mostafa Khoshkesh, journalist and political commentator out of Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with me on the spotlight. Well, let's start it off with Hafsa. Good to see you. It's been a long time. Why do you think the U.S. media is reporting that Mossad committed this act of terrorism now?
It's difficult to say, but I would assume that, first of all, there's a sort of a step-by-step way in which these killings are usually carried out. First, they do them. No one takes responsibility for them. When a country, such as Iran, actually points the finger at the culprit, they will then say you're a conspiracy theorist. You're obviously automatically blaming Mossad, which is a classic tactic. And then once the story has been completely forgotten, they come back and then they take responsibility for it in order to come across as democratic and people who actually carry out investigations. So throughout these step-by-steps, and we've seen this many, many times, it's sort of like constantly win, win, win. First of all, they get to accuse the victim of being conspiracy theorist. And second of all, they then come across about a year later or several years later coming back and saying, well, actually, we have done our work, we have investigated, and this happens to have been carried out by our closest ally, Israel. So I would suspect this is why they've done it at this moment in time. Exactly why, I cannot say, I'm afraid, but I think this sort of carries, it sort of follows the usual step-by-step way with which these assassinations are carried out.
Mostafa, the article talks about U.S. collusion at the highest level. So this information is reported, and at the end, nothing is done about this. None of them, neither entity, is held responsible. I mean, what is this? Is this simply the law of the jungle?
Hello, Marzia. Thanks for having me. Well, let me answer the question that you asked from my colleague first, if I may.
Sure.
You know, the report doesn't give you anything new. The whole reporting that it does had already been stated by Iranian news agencies, including Iran's Fars news agency, gave a full and detailed explanation about events that day, the day that Dr. Fakhrizadeh was assassinated, the trajectory, the developments in detail, especially about the weapon that was used. They said that it was a remotely operated machine gun. They even released a picture of a full range or class of such weapons that are produced by NATO members like Spain, Sweden, Belgium, the United States, Russia, China, and even Iran. In a follow-up report, they even released a picture of an Iranian rival of the same product to disclose that it has been such a weapon. But many inside and outside Iran rejected the report outright for being some kind of oversimplification. So there is nothing new in this report that comes forward, but the aim is building up credit for Israel and Israeli Secret Service and Mossad. First, with regard to the weapon that they have used, Ronan Bergman, who's known to be a Mossad agent, is trying to say that it's been a robot. We do know that robots act independently. They don't need an operator. If you got a drone technology, a UAV technology, that sends, you know, an operator, works with the drone and shoots and targets through bombings and comes back home, then you definitely could make such a remotely operated machine gun. It doesn't have anything but a few optical cameras, and you need the satellite connection, and that's it. But, you know, what matters in here, that he is trying to say it's been a robot, in order to claim that it's been a clear-cut technology owned by Israel, especially when he says that it's been the first time that such a weapon has been used and made by the Israelis. So it's a false reporting in order to make credit. That's the first thing. The second thing is taking credit for highly valued targets. It's the first time that they claim responsibility, because he is known to be a Mossad agent. It matters a lot that he claims responsibility for the assassination of several Iranian scientists. But at the conclusion, he tries to claim responsibility for the death of the father of Iran's missile industry, Major Tehrani Moghaddam, which is absurd because it was an incident. We do know it because General Tehrani Moghaddam evacuated the facility and area through automatic, systematic reporting because of the risks and danger. A day earlier, he informed everyone to evacuate the facility, except for his team of a few dozens.
So at the end of the day, Mostafa, what you're saying is basically they're trying to use this article to create this image that Israel is invincible and can do whatever it wants at any time, anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Stay with me, Mostafa. Let me get Hafsa. Let me get Hafsa back in on this conversation. Hafsa, I'm going to throw that question that I had mentioned to Mostafa back at you. Basically, this whole what does it mean when you have this so-called law of the jungle that's basically the norm now?
I mean, you said it perfectly well. It is about saying that we can do whatever we want and we won't be accountable for it. This is not, as I said previously, this isn't the first time. Remember back in Dubai a few years back, they assassinated quite openly Hamas militants, and they took credit for it, and their allies fully recognized that they had done it. There was some sort of very mealy-mouthed condemnation, because of course you don't do that. These were official representatives of Hamas who'd been assassinated in some sort of James Bond-esque scenario. And what the Israelis like to do is precisely show off to the world that they are invincible, Why? Because they have the backing and the support and the unconditional support of the most powerful nation on the planet. And in this case, given that even the President of the United States himself was present at the meeting, this literally confirms that this was done in, not only with their full acknowledgement, but with their full cooperation. So it's a way of saying, well, you can't touch us because here's who's backing, who's got our backs. And they will take credit for it because it does show Israel to be invincible. And let's not forget that they don't always, they don't just have the backing of the US, they have the unconditional backing of the EU, and they also have strong support with Putin's Russia. So in essence, Israel really has the backing and the support of the most powerful nations on the planet, and this is why it behaves in such a roguish manner.
Mustafa, you know, what is interesting about this article is that it does not mention any international agencies such as the UN condemning the terrorist act, nor does it talk about making sure the perpetrators pay for the crime. It's absolutely amazing that you're talking about this type of terrorism, but on the other hand, nothing is said about any type of accountability. Your take about the lack of any action by these so-called international agencies?
Well, double standards have caused the spread of terrorism all across the globe. More interestingly, I mean, if this report is interesting, it's because of three points that happened for the first time, and this would lay a very big question mark on the role of the United Nations and the world community, why they refuse to take action against the Israeli state terrorism. The first point in here is that it's the first time, you know, Ronan Bergman, he has authored several books and articles all aimed at Iran. You don't get access to such sensitive information unless you're a part of the Mossad or some secret service. And even if you do, when you release such vital information, you are jailed, you are persecuted. If it's not part of the Israeli or any other Secret Service plan against the target, Bergman actually has been working on mass intimidation among the target nation, that's the Iranian nation, among Iranian officials, to intimidate them, to show that Israel has a superior hand when we know that Israel is very fragile and under much pressure from inside, from outside, from the side of the Palestinians and others. Now, he is part of, you know, this Israeli Mossad soft operation plan against the Iranian nation. He has got an endorsed mission by them. That's why it matters a lot when he claims responsibility for the assassination of Dr. Masoud Ali Mohammadi. It's the first time that they claim responsibility for his assassination in 2010. The second point, it's the first time he claims responsibility that assassin, the motor rider who stuck the bomb to the car door, was Majid Fashi, and the guy that was arrested, tried and executed by Iran after he appeared on Iranian TV to make public confessions about the detail of how he was trained in Israel and how he worked for the Israeli Mossad agency. The Israelis have always denied any kind of link to Majid Jamal Fashi. A third point, which still is much more important, is the first time that Israelis claim responsibility for the assassination of Iranian university professor and scientist Dr. Ardashir Hosseinpour in 2007 after they poisoned him with radioactive material. That matters a lot. That shows different kind of terrorism done by Israelis so openly in conjunction, partnership, and complicity with the United States, and the world refuses to take any kind of action, and they just know that Israel is the only Middle Eastern regime that is armed with nuclear weapons. They are a terrorist regime, and still the IAEA pressures Iran and intimidates Iran with resolution at the Board of Governors, and the Europeans are asking Iran, and the U.S. is pressuring Iran through sanctions to get back to the Vienna talks, and they have given the Israelis the role of intimidation within the U.S. containment strategy They want Israel to intimidate the Iranian nation, okay. And that's why they have released the report right now.
Well, how's that? You know, on the one hand, Western countries have been talking about their war on terrorism for 20 years, and on the other hand, they participated, encouraged, and or ignored some of the main terrorist attacks during that same period. What does all this mean? I mean, how do you put all of this together?
Well, I think essentially these imperialist nations were built on terrorism, were built on the violation of the basic rights of the countries and the peoples they colonize. And I think they perpetrate this sort of policy and mindset. Just recently, we learned that they, in leaving Afghanistan, they literally exterminated an entire family. Now, of course, for some bizarre reason, they've actually come clean and they did recognize the error. But had they not recognized it, we would just have assumed that they were legitimate war targets. And no one would be the wiser. The idea is that the bottom line is that for these nations, these supremacist nations, countries of the South, essentially, are disposable. The lives of their people are not, they do not have the same values as those of Western nations, and they continue to behave in such a way. Just to pick up on the point about the NGOs, I have to say that these supposedly international NGOs are simply there to provide, more often than not, the modus operandi, the casus belli for countries to go to war. We've seen this many times, Amnesty International literally backing up accusations that are made up essentially by Western nations, and then coming clean, for instance, a few years down the line, saying, well, actually, we got that wrong. I'm thinking, for instance, Amnesty International in the case of Libya, when they came up with stories that Libyan soldiers were using Viagra to gang rape women, and then 5 years later, they recognized that it was a completely wrong mistake, that it was absolutely a fabricated story. But at the time of the invasion and the attack on Libya, this was pushed by Hillary Clinton, for instance, as a case for going to war. Cases such as these are numerous across the world, and they're constantly used by NGOs who are essentially the PR agencies of these governments, because they come forward and they provide the case, and they make the PR for war. These then are used as supposedly credible sources, and public opinion then starts backing conflict against the countries of the South. So this is nothing more than a perpetuation of imperialistic attitudes and supremacist attitudes, whereby these countries behave with the countries of the South in a way that is based on terrorism, simply because they do not recognize that the peoples of the South have the same value as their own.
Mustafa, Dr. Fakhrizadeh was a top scientist, of a course, and he was working on a COVID-19 vaccine even. Imagine any of these entities and their top scientists being assassinated by another government. I mean, what would be the reaction, and why shouldn't the standard be the same when it comes to the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, definitely the answer is clear. Iran is trying to stand independent. Iran is the major obstacle that they see in the Middle East that has prevented them from establishing their order and hegemonic rule over the Middle East in order to, you know, get to China fast and try to slow down its economy. They have been trying to do so two times so far. In the first and second decade of this millennium, they tried to do so, and Iran never allowed them to impose their hegemonic rule and threaten Iran and, you know, the nations of the region. It was just a few years ago that a top Pentagon commander, was speaking of this very fact, that they intended to subvert and, decompose of seven nations after 2001 in a matter of 5 years: Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Somalia, Sudan, Libya, and Syria, of course. And, you know, the only nation that stood against them and they never dared to attack it was Iran. What they do is trying to contain Iran first and, you know, roll back its power components growth, the growth of its nuclear industry, missile industry, regional power, in order to make it weak. And then once this is done, they would go for a subversion, for an attack, or for some other kind of subversion, like coup d'etat or whatever, So the only obstacle that they have on their way has been Iran. Iran represents a role model. That Pentagon commander mentioned it very directly, quote unquote, that we would and we should not, never, ever allow a country like Iran to become a role model for other nations in this region, because they are in pursuit of their illegitimate interests in this region, and Iran is the only main nation that's standing outright against them.
Okay. Well, Hafsa, what about that? Is it all about that? Is it about, is it on the one hand the West's enmity for an independent Iran, basically not wanting Iran to become a role model, as Mostafa said, or what's your assessment of it?
I totally agree. I think Iran is sort of sticking in the West's throat for various reasons. One, because obviously it's resisting. It has refused to capitulate despite the crippling sanctions and despite pressure that is unbelievable. It's still there. It's still standing strong, and it hasn't collapsed. And that is something that Western nations are really struggling to accept. But of course, it's also because it is the idea of a powerful, of a sophisticated, well-structured Islamic nation is something that is very problematic for Western nations. Because, of course, if Iran wasn't the Islamic Republic, I think it would be less problematic for many Western countries. But the idea of a powerful Islamic Republic that is on the verge of acquiring the nuclear technology, etc., is something that is very difficult to accept. And this is why the propaganda against Iran continues, the animosity towards both Iran and the Iranian people, because however much they insist that there is a distinction between how they view the Iranian government and the Iranian people, the bottom line is the sanctions obviously punish both the government and the people of Iran. So there is this constant propaganda against Iran, simply because I think Western nations cannot fathom the idea of a strong regional power in the Middle East, but most of all, a strong regional Islamic power in the Middle East. That is something that is going to be very difficult to accept, and that is why I'm afraid Iran should expect even more pressure in the years to come.
Well, Mostafa, with the reality of the world the way it is, with might making right, is there any other option for Iran and other independent countries than basically resistance?
Well, there's arguments because that they even acknowledge and make confessions about what they've done. It's not just about Fakhrizadeh. It's about other people that they've done. I mean, they assassinated the Major General, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. And in this New York Times report by Ronan Bergman, as I said, he has made first-time confessions about three other facts about assassination of two other Iranian nuclear scientists, especially with regard to the 2007 assassination of Dr. Ardeshir Hosseinpour with radioactive materials. Because they go unpunished by the world community, that means that if you just pinhole on international circles and on the UN Security Council, Amnesty International, and others, you will be the victim and you will be destroyed because they don't take any kind of action. It proves that language of force is the only language that they understand. Maybe that explains why the Israelis' growing attack, security attack, sabotage, and assassination throughout the last 2 or 3 years on Iran have never, ever gone unpunished one way or another. They assassinated Dr. Fakhrizadeh. They conduct a sabotage attack at Natanz facility. They set fire to Iranian goods, and they did some other moves. And they, of course, tried to magnify the number, and they went for hyperbole, and they claimed responsibility for dozens of more attacks, which were not true, similar to what Ronan Bergman claims about the assassination of Major General, Tehrani Mokaddem, the father of the Iranian missile technology, but they received a response swiftly. You know, let me explain this. Okay. Maybe you're short of time.
I am. I'm exactly very short of time, Mostafa, and hopefully on another show we'll talk about it again. I appreciate both of you being with me here on the spotlight. Hafsakar Mostafa, journalist and political analyst out of London. Mostafa Khoshchesh, journalist and political commentator out of Tehran. And of course, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Exhausted healthcare workers admit they feel demoralized as the fourth coronavirus surge spreads across the United States. We now present you an article written by Sadia Rafiquddin under the heading, Doctors Treating Unvaccinated COVID Patients Are Succumbing to Compassion Fatigue. Last February, Dr. Bryce Mack, a 30-year-old, would lock herself in the bathroom to cry for 5 minutes where her patients, whom she had watched over for weeks in the medical intensive care unit, were dying from COVID-19. They begged her to tell people in their community to get vaccinated. Of the 20 patients with COVID-19 in her care, only 3 survived. Each week, Dr. Mack's frustration grew when she saw patients in a Columbia, Missouri primary care clinic. They expressed vaccine hesitancy, shared misinformation, or told her that their friends were pressuring them to remain unvaccinated. Dr. Mack, who continues to experience long-term effects of the virus herself, said, if only the patients in the clinic could just meet the people who are suffering in the hospital. Now more than ever before, medical professionals are drained from the relentless grief and trauma of the pandemic. But it's more than the volume of patients that's the problem. They're dealing with the dissonance of unvaccinated patients and constraints of the health system, leaving them without the tools to do their jobs the way they were trained to do so. The stakes are high for a workforce facing this psychological and emotional toll. Doctors are given little support or leeway for mistakes and suffer professional consequences when they disclose mental health problems. Some of what they're experiencing can be encapsulated in 2 terms, experts say: moral injury and compassion fatigue. Dr. Kiernan Mannion, executive director of the Center for Physician Rights, said, "Compassion fatigue is the feeling it's hard to care when you're overloaded, but still dedicated to the task. Adding, moral injury occurs when the nurse or doctor feels that the patients I've dedicated my life to treating are now here because of their own negligence, and now they're imposing upon me and my team to treat them while also exposing us to continued danger from this virus. These days, Dr. Mack knows that firsthand. She is seeing more children with COVID-19 at her Missouri hospital than ever before. At 46%, Missouri has one of the lowest rates of full vaccination in the country. Dr. Mack says, "I don't even get the chance to try to show you all the split-second decisions and critical thinking and compassion I'm capable of." She adds, "Practicing mindfulness is not going to fix moral injury." In Kansas, intensive care unit beds are occupied with more COVID-19 patients now than at any other time during the pandemic. Morgues are overwhelmed in Oregon, and doctors in Palm Beach County, Florida, pleaded with the public in a news conference to trust them and get vaccinated. Dr. Anita Sirkar, a California-based infectious disease doctor, can't help but feel angry at patients that are life-threateningly ill from COVID-19, but could have avoided their illness by taking the vaccine. She said in a widely shared opinion editorial, compassion fatigue was setting in, adding, "For those of us who had left after the hardest year of our professional lives, even hope was now in short supply." According to Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and chief medical advisor to President Joe Biden, so far nearly 660,000 people have died of COVID-19 in the United States. With the current spike in cases, that number is expected to rise by another 100,000 or so by December. Medical school didn't prepare Dr. Michelle Hsu, a 29-year-old, an emergency medicine resident, to tackle misinformation. Reflecting on the COVID-19 surge in Houston, Texas last summer and the impact it had on her patients, she said, "We didn't have any magic tricks up our sleeves, so it felt demoralizing and helpless. That's what makes this wave of the pandemic so hard to watch, because we have a vaccine and we know that it works." Dr. Leah Brown, a 46-year-old, received every vaccine known to man when she was on active duty in the military for 12 years. Now the Arizona-based orthopedic surgeon is frustrated by the unvaccinated population that is making the pandemic feel like a battleground. Dr. Leah Brown says, "Medicine is based on science and experts. I don't know when expert opinion or expert knowledge took a backseat to politics." The consequences of the COVID surge are severe for Dr. Brown's patients. She is forced to tell them that they can't have their shoulder replaced or a spine operation because there are no intensive care unit beds or nurses to do the surgery. She worries that people will continue to get sicker and stressed without timely care. As this weighs heavily on doctors across the country, their own options for seeking help can be limited. Unlike other professions, physicians exposed to the occupational hazards of their jobs face multiple barriers to mental health care. They can be asked invasive questions about their mental health history in applications for a state medical license, hospital privileges, credentialing by insurance providers, and medical malpractice insurance, or risk their medical records being subpoenaed in the event of a lawsuit. They can be sent to a physician health program, controversial programs that were established to help doctors in difficult times. Doctors die by suicide at the highest rate of any profession. Dr. Brown says. We probably have the most liability of any profession, so if you don't follow the standard of care, not only are you judged and ostracized by your peers, we are punished. She added, we're having to work through all of that in the face of navigating willfully non-compliant patients who would rather poison themselves with therapies that haven't been tested than help with a public health disaster. Corey Feist, co-founder of the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation, which advocates for the well-being of physicians, says, there is such a stigma and is so reinforced for these doctors that they don't believe the rules are in their favor. The organization honors Dr. Lorna Breen, medical director of the emergency department at a New York City hospital who died by suicide on 26th of April 2020. Corey Feist said she was terrified of her professional reputation being damaged if anyone got a whiff of a thought that she can't keep up. Dr. Mona Massoud, a Philadelphia-based psychiatrist, co-founded Physicians Support Line, a free confidential peer-to-peer phone service staffed by 800 volunteer psychiatrists. Prompted by the crisis physicians faced early in the pandemic, they have given nearly 10,000 minutes a month of help to doctors. The support line doesn't have to report the callers because the volunteers don't have a formal doctor-patient relationship, enabling many physicians to get some help without the fear that their private conversations and medical conditions will be disclosed. With many conversations centering on compassion fatigue and a breakdown of the doctor-patient relationship, Dr. Mona Massoud says there has been a definite uptick in calls during the pandemic. There is a feeling that I'm risking my life, my family's life, my own well-being for people who don't care about me. Meanwhile, Beck says physicians and other medical professionals need confidential mental health care to cope with the moral injury they're suffering during the pandemic. Healthcare workers are managing with so few resources that all they can do is triage, which is similar to functioning in a humanitarian disaster. Beck says this wasn't avoidable for Detroit or New York because the vaccine wasn't available. But it is avoidable now, and yet here we are. That just kills people's souls.